You're listening to KUOW's The Record. Welcome, I'm Bill Radke. Today, along with other Seattle news media, we're spotlighting the issue of homelessness. We'll tweet out links to our most recent coverage on the issue. You'll find those on Twitter at KUOW. You can join this conversation on Twitter and Facebook. Just search the hashtag SeaHomeless, S-E-A, homeless. First of all, I would like you to meet Troy Morgan. Troy moved to Seattle in 2014. He was living in Las Vegas, suffering from chronic pain from an old workplace injury. He heard the UW had a good medical program. Coming here, he thought, would help him realize his dreams.
I've always wanted to retire here since the early 80s on a houseboat. And I was hoping to open a little store or something like that to augment my income and to help put my sister through college.
When Troy got to Seattle, he and his sister found a very different reality from what he had hoped for. It was too expensive for them. After living in a hotel for a couple of months, he and his sister ended up on the street.
That was crushing in more ways than one. Being permanently disabled, knowing I can't do a lot of the things I need to do on a daily basis to gain that retirement boat. As an older brother, watching the fact that my sister had to live on the streets for the first time in her life, ever. No, it was crushing in more ways than one. But what I found after ending up in the street system is a kind of kindred spirit family between the homeless. Because once you get to know them, you'll find that there's a lot more going on than meets the eye. A lot of stories, a lot of different types of personalities, a lot of people growing up in different types of environments and worlds and cultures. You just got to take the time to listen.
You're living in an unauthorized tent camp now, right, called Camp Liberty?
Yes.
What's that like?
Like any other normal community, we have some that go to work to day labor. We have some who are disabled, myself included. We each work together to keep the camp clean, finding out the best ways to work together. It's a normal community, like any other. It just has a stigma about it because we're currently living in tents. That stigma is asinine. We're a normal community, like any apartment complex in this city. We grew together as a group because of the common problem we had. There's a bunch of good people out there that just have a few problems. Some of it's financial, like for me and my family, it's financial. I only make $700 a month on disability, so it's kind of hard for me to live here.
Did you consider going back to Las Vegas?
There's
or someplace else cheaper?
Why should I? I came here to retire in a dream home and environment. If I'm not willing to fight for it, then I don't have the right to it. I don't want to give up and just run away. I wasn't raised that way, and neither was anyone else in this camp. We were all raised in a way that said you have to fight each and every day and learn something new each and every day in order to grow as a person. And that's what we're doing. We're actually growing into a community that's slowly getting beyond the community and more of a family.
What is your goal, Troy? Do you want to live outside? Are you trying to get...
No, actually, I have a much grander goal than that. I want Camps with a Heart to become very, very successful.
Your vision is a more successful camp. What about shelter? What about a home?
That's what these new camps are being structured as. The proposal that I'm putting together for several of the larger corporations that headquarter or have major offices here in this city is that they invest in one or two container-style homes by just getting the container and then flipping it over to a one-bedroom apartment. That's stage one. And then we are trying to raise money now to buy the land. Put those containers on that land. That's a permanent, well-structured home. Use that as a transient center to build, future camps to help get these people off the streets. if they want the help.
Shipping containers used as small apartments.
Yeah.
Who would live there?
Any and all people that have addictions that are not being taken care of through normal means. That is a goal that needs to be done because so much of two-thirds of the homeless out there are being ignored because there are not any type of housing that would give them the ability to use but to decrease in slow increments so they don't suffer, so their minds don't crack. And it would be run by the people who actually know what it's like to be where they are so they can help one another.
Is there an addiction you're trying to kick?
For 8 years of my life after my spinal surgery, I was taking 60 milligrams of morphine 3 times a day to combat the pain. I'm still in pain. I'm not on that addiction anymore. I haven't had it in 2.5 years, but now my pain is 10 to 100 times fold every day. I am actually in the process of a self-experiment to see which medical-grade marijuanas and recreational marijuanas could help ease the pain enough for me to still function on a daily basis. I'm an ex-military. I'm ex-activist. I'm an ex-bartender. I've done a lot of traveling around this country during my life, and I learned from a lot of different people. I'd like to be able to start using that to help others now. That's my goal. That's my motivation.
We sure talked to the city, county officials about how they want to get people in shelter, off the streets. You're rolling your eyes.
Yeah. I don't want to say this in a bad way, but certain people in politics today shouldn't be in politics. They should go crawl in a hole. They haven't got the first clue what it means to help somebody out on the streets because they don't live on here. And they won't listen to us. So the policies and the things they're doing, it doesn't work. Not all the people in the street are bad. And it burns me up to think that these people in power would just rather look at us and see us as one way without actually getting to know us.
What do you want our listeners to know about you and the people you know in the streets?
In my camp alone, I have 4 people who would love to go to college. They just need a stable home or environment. That's what we're trying to give them as a unit. I've got people that work every day of the week through type services. They just need a stable, safe environment to lay down their head at night. Yes, we have problems, but we know how to help each other because we've been there. We're not products of our current situation. We're products of life. We've done a lot. Many of us have. All those experiences coming together in one melting pot, we can make great things happen. We just need somebody to listen.
That's Troy Morgan. He and his sister have been homeless in Seattle for 2 years. They now live in one of the unauthorized camps in town. Morgan says most people who live in his camp don't want to go into shelters. Now, Troy talked there about housing people in shipping containers. It turns out Paul Allen is thinking something similar. Today's Seattle Times reports the Microsoft co-founder is donating $1 million to help build 13 housing units made of box-like steel modules, kind of like shipping containers. They'll go into Seattle's Columbia City neighborhood, and they're for people transitioning out of homelessness. Those steel modules are relatively cheap to build, presumably more comfortable and secure than tents. Today, we are spotlighting the issue of homelessness here on KUOW, along with other Seattle news media. So we've launched a Facebook group called Ask Seattle's Homeless Community. Anybody there can ask a question, but only people who have been homeless can answer. You'll find that on Facebook. Search for Ask Seattle's Homeless Community. We'll also tweet out a link to that right now at KUOW. And in a few minutes here, we're going to talk with Seattle's Mayor Ed Murray. He'll tell you what's happened in the about 8 months since he's declared a state of emergency around homelessness. That conversation's coming up in about a half hour. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. KPLU is going out on its own. Yesterday, the folks who run the station announced a deal to buy the 88.5 FM frequency from the university that has held the license, Pacific Lutheran University. That means KPLU will not be acquired by KUOW, which is licensed to the University of Washington. KUOW had made a bid to buy the station. KPLU General Manager Joey Cohn told me about the deal with Pacific Lutheran.
What we agreed to is to purchase the KPLU radio license for $7 million in cash and $1 million in in-kind underwriting. In addition to that, we're going to retain all staff, and PLU will allow us to continue to work out of the Neeb Center on the PLU campus free of charge for the next 3 years.
So no merger, huh? We're not going to get together?
No merger, no acquisition. We still are collaborating. One of the important collaborations that we've worked on together has been the Northwest News Network.
Yep.
And so that's been really good, I think. A very good model of a way that we can work together.
Now you're not going to be part of Pacific Lutheran anymore, so what's your station going to sound like now? You could do anything.
Well, I think immediately we're going to continue to sound the way that we do, though we do have plans for some new shows. Soon we're going to launch a new jazz show with new emerging artists. We also have plans for a Latin jazz show. But I think the station's going to evolve in ways that we don't even know yet, but I know it is definitely going to evolve over time. One of the good things that we did through the campaign was to hold a lot of community meetings all over the Puget Sound and listen to people and what they had to say about the station, and we want to continue to carry on those conversations and present people with some of our ideas. We want to hear people's reaction to them, and I think it's going to be more of a collaboration between the new KPLU or the Friends of 88.5 FM and our audience. Being more ingrained in the community, I think, is something that we feel very strongly about, and it'll be interesting to see how that affects our programming.
Joey, you've said you're not going to have to lay anybody off. You raised the money to buy the frequency, and you have the studio space, but where are you going to get the money to employ the local staff who makes the news and the jazz programming, and where are you going to find the money to buy programming like from NPR and PRI?
Well, KPLU was a self-sustaining operation for over 25 years. We had our best fiscal year last year, and our audit is online. You can see it, but we were in the black $389,000 last year. So we know how to successfully run a public radio station. We did it for many years, and now that we're making the purchase of the radio station, it allows us to get back on track and to raise money and bring in support through all the different ways that public radio brings in revenue. We'll just get back on track to do what we were doing before, which we're looking forward to.
Do you know whether you're going to buy the same flagship NPR shows? Because right now we have Morning Edition on two local stations at the same time, all things considered. Is that going to keep happening?
Yes, that'll keep happening. The Seattle-Tacoma radio market is the number one radio market for public radio in the entire country. The best way to put this is that there's more public radio listeners per capita in the Seattle-Tacoma market than anywhere else in the country. It's over 30%. Why? Because we have very successful stations here, KUOW, KPLU, King FM, KEXP, to name a few. So, my take on it is, yes, there is some duplication of programming, but there's a lot of the programming that is not duplicated, and there's definitely a different personality between the radio stations, too. So there's some crossover, but at the same time, there's a lot that's unique to each radio station. And I think what it comes down to is if these radio stations have the support of their listeners, what's wrong with that? I think the bottom line is we want to do more for the community and not less.
You are still going to be 88.5 FM, but you're not going to be KPLU. What are your call letters going to be?
Well, we don't know yet. We're going to ask the listeners to give us input on that, and the call letters that are chosen, the person that picks the call letters that we choose, will get to be the first person to go on the air and say those call letters.
You're going to put it to a listener vote. Be careful with that. Remember Bodie McBoatface. You know, when you let people vote, you never know what's going
to
happen.
Well, that's why, you know, we don't want it to be a contest. We want it to be more like input from the listeners. But I think the more people that are thinking about the call letters and what the possibilities could be, the better. So we want to open it up to lots of people because, you know, you never know. Somebody might have a great idea. So, you know, we want to hear from a lot of different people.
Talking to Joey Cohn, general manager at what so far is still KPLU FM. Joey, we have a lot of listeners in common. Are KPLU fans mad at KUOW?
I mean, I can't speak for them and answer that question.
How about you? Are you and I, are we good?
I'm not mad at you guys at all.
Okay.
Actually, Bill, you kind of make me mad. I don't know why. There's something about you.
So I'm just irritated.
You know, the thing is that, I mean, you've been involved with KUOW for many years. I mean, you started at KPLU.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been at KPLU for almost 29 years. And there are people that have worked at both stations. You know, we have friends back and forth at both stations.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that it's a friendly rivalry. I think we've pushed each other over the years to be better. I think if you're the only game in town, you can get kind of lazy. And I've seen that in other radio markets around the country. You know, like if you're the only game in town in Chicago, for example, just to pick on Chicago for a second, you know, it's like, hey, open up the, you know, floodgates and, you know, you run Morning Edition, you're just going to get the support from people because you're the only game in town. But I think having two stations, I think it pushes both of us to be better.
I like to think so too, Joey. You know, I'm personally disappointed that we won't get to be together more and work together more as we've done for a long time. But I think we love you here and you guys do a great job. And congratulations on the fundraiser and the deal and continued success.
Well, thank you, Bill. We have a lot of respect for you guys. You've been very successful for many years. And, you know, good wishes to both of us. You know, it's all about serving our listeners, our community. And, you know, that's what we're both about. And that's what we both intend. I mean, I'll speak for KPLU and I'm sure it's the same for you. But that's our intention, you know, is to continue to be important to our community.
Joey Cohn, always good to talk with you, brother. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
KPLU General Manager Joey Cohn talking with Bill Radke on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Earlier this year, two Seattle police officers shot and killed a man named Shay Taylor, and now the Seattle Police Department's Force Review Board has ruled that the shooting was reasonable. Seattle Times criminal justice reporter Steve Miletich reminds us what led up to the moment Shay Taylor was shot.
The Seattle police were conducting a surveillance operation in North Seattle in the Wedgewood neighborhood of a person other than Mr. Taylor, a suspected narcotics dealer. I believe they were watching a house. Mr. Taylor showed up at the scene. Officers say they saw him with a gun that was in a holster. Because he was a felon who had spent time in prison, they decided to arrest him as a felon in illegal possession of a firearm. And they devised a plan to arrest him and moved in on him as he got out of a parked car. And as he was next to that car, police say that he reached for the gun, what they believed was the gun, still in the holster. And at that point, the two officers opened fire and Mr. Taylor was killed.
How sure is an officer supposed to be to feel that a suspect actually is reaching for a gun, not just he might be reaching for a gun? How sure should an officer be before they're allowed to shoot to kill?
Well, I think there's a standard called objective reasonableness where they have to have, as that term suggests, you know, a reasonable and objective belief that a person is reaching for a gun or presents a threat to their safety and their lives. And, you know, that's what is generally used to evaluate the decision-making of an officer.
You know, this question has come up in not just this shooting, but so many. The question of maybe the officers were justified, but couldn't they have de-escalated, gone out of their way to de-escalate the situation? If they knew he had a gun, I mean, I don't know what would have worked better, but you could imagine the officer saying, "We know you've got a gun, you know, Shay, don't think about it, move away from the car," you know. Instead, it all happened so fast, and he's dead.
Yeah, there's various scenarios you can play out in these situations. I believe, and I'd have to have the statements in front of me, but I believe the officers were concerned about two other people who were in the car and whether Mr. Taylor would try to get back in the car and drive off, and then you'd have a hostage situation.
Mm-hmm.
There also is, you know, he could run into the neighborhood or run into a house. You know, those are factors that they often look at in these situations. You know, specifically this one, I think we'll have to see exactly what the officers say. But I think they came up with a plan that they thought would contain him.
Yeah, and really we're getting here, Steve, at things that make it very difficult, maybe understandably difficult, to prosecute police officers. Shea Taylor's brother, who called this shooting unjustified, wants to get state law changed to make it easier to prosecute police officers over the use of deadly force. So what does the law say now, and what's the change that he wants?
Well, the law has basically makes it virtually impossible to prosecute a police officer over the use of deadly force because of two words, malice and good faith. A prosecutor would have to show that a officer-involved fatal shooting resulted from malice, which is defined as evil intent, and a lack of good faith. And those are extremely high bars for a prosecutor to get over, and it has resulted in only one case of an officer being charged, and that officer was acquitted. And that was up in Snohomish County.
What do you think the odds are that state law changes along those lines?
Well, I think it's going to be difficult because there's a lot of resistance from the Washington State Sheriffs and Police Chiefs Association and other law enforcement people. But it is a matter that's under study. The legislature was presented with a bill that would have repealed that language that I just mentioned during the last session. They opted not to do that, but they did create a task force that will report to the governor on recommendations regarding that law. It's a task force of a broad array of people from various quarters and police to community activists. I believe they had a meeting in the last few days, one of their kind of a get-started meeting, and that will play out over time, and we'll see what recommendations they come up with and whether they believe the law should be amended or not, and then could come up in the next legislative session.
Okay, so we may still be talking about that standard, malice and good faith, as you said. Okay, we'll follow that. Finally, though, Steve, the police department's force review board has signed off basically on how this shooting was handled. But does that mean that Shea Taylor's family, is this the end of it? Could the family get some kind of civil settlement against the police department?
Well, I think there's two steps there. One is that there'll be a court inquest in September, which is essentially a fact-finding type proceeding in which the jury will look at causes and circumstances. Now, they do not determine if it was justified, although they answer questions along the line of did the officers fear for their lives, that type of thing. It's not a civil or criminal proceeding. The results of the inquest do go to the prosecutor's office for review. And then the second step, and we don't know if this will happen, is whether the Taylor family will bring some kind of claim and civil litigation against the police department. That hasn't happened at this point, and it may be that they will wait for the inquest to consider that step, but that would be a separate civil action.
Seattle Times criminal justice reporter Steve Miletich. The full report from Seattle Police Department's Force Review Board is expected out in the next couple of weeks, so that ought to tell us more about why the review board found the shooting of Shea Taylor to be reasonable. You're listening to The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. You're about to hear now a story of domestic violence and a woman who's trying to help. Courtney Weaver met Kenneth Fiawi in 2009. A year into the relationship, Kenneth became abusive. He eventually shot her several times. Courtney is a blues singer here in Seattle, and she's been using her voice to advocate for other survivors. She told KUOW's Jeannie Yendel what happened on the night of the shooting. And a word of caution, you might find these details of domestic abuse disturbing. Courtney says that Kenneth had always been jealous. He was even jealous of her four-month-old cat, Raja. The night of the shooting, Courtney was in her bathroom getting ready for an evening out with some friends. Kenneth did not want her to go.
He ended up grabbing my cat and throwing her against the 8-foot wall that was adjacent my bedroom wall. And I began to just, you know, agree, do everything I could to de-escalate him because I knew he had the gun on him. I'm looking up, and I'd heard 5 shots go off, and I'd covered my ears to shield myself from the bullets. And I just remember seeing his face and the light blaring above me and the broken window behind him. And he just had this blank look on his face of like a bewildered little boy. And he just looked at me and ran out the door and ran up the street. And I jumped up to grab my purse, and I realized that I had a 3-inch hole in my arm. And knowing me, I just kept trying to grab my purse. You know, it's like so inclination. I just couldn't understand why my hands couldn't grip at my purse. And finally, after like the 4th or 5th time, I'm like, well, there's a hole that I can see through to the floor, so I probably should just use my other arm to pick up my purse.
But at what point did you realize that it was more than just that one thing that happened to your arm? At what point did you realize it was more than just, I can't pick up my purse?
So when I realized I couldn't pick up my purse in my right hand, I tourniqueted the arm with the sweatshirt, and I opened my mouth as I went to the foyer, and I just had blood and teeth and gums just stream down my face. It was a shock. For one, at this point, I wasn't in any pain. And that survival instinct kicked in really, really fast. Like, my whole thing was like, I need to get help. I need to get it now. And it was like this, you know, like the self-talk in my brain was like, breathe, keep your eyes open, keep going, get help. And it's a really interesting feeling. It's something that's very, very guttural and almost, you know, it's part of our chemical makeup. Like, we will do anything to stay alive.
Well, you didn't have a lot of control over how this became publicized. The fact that the media chose to cover this shooting, the fact that they talked about you, that they talked about Kenneth. But you've also said that initially you felt embarrassed about what happened. What was embarrassing for you about what happened?
It was the most humiliating thing that ever happened to me. You know, for one, this is like an intimate, private, sacred relationship. You know, that he just happened to be a charming, intelligent man who was violent. A lot of my advocacy was me just trying to articulate everything that happened and discovering myself and discovering, okay, well, what, you know, I'm a blues singer and now I'm the girl that got shot in the face by my boyfriend and I don't want to be just that. And so, you know, it really kind of helped me cope a lot with not only the excruciating physical pain, but also, you know, the emotional pain of having someone you love and not even be able to fathom why they would do that to you.
Is there a song that you'd like to sing now that explores some of what you just told me about speaking for yourself versus feeling embarrassed by what happened?
There's a song I wrote called Make Up for That Day. And I remember the first time that I saw a mirror in the hospital. They wouldn't let me see a mirror for the first 10 days I was in there. And I was petrified. And I had tears coming down my face. And I remember putting makeup on in the mirror and how empowering that was for me, but also knowing like, well, it's not like it's going to like hide it, but it made me feel more like myself to like put on the same makeup that I'd had and put on regular street clothes. So it's a nod to that. And it's a nod to what it means to be a woman and have your name dragged through the mud and have it be on everyone's list while you're coping with that heartbreak and trying to be yourself again.
Makes me so sad. Miss a love I never had. No cover up can hide away or make up for that day. At the tender age of 22.
I'm talking with Courtney Weaver. She's a blues singer here in Seattle. Her new record is called Paper Tiger. We're also talking about how she became a gun control advocate here in Washington State. You described becoming an advocate for gun control measures as accidental, or at least you've heard other people describe it as becoming an advocate accidentally. And you actually helped pass a measure here in Washington State that limited people with domestic abuse violations, limiting them from having access to guns. But while you were testifying in the state legislature, you told our producer, Matt Martin, you actually overheard some lawmakers say that you should be, and I'm using air quotes here for people who aren't in the room, you should be acting more like a victim.
Yeah.
What did you think when you heard that?
I kind of laughed to myself. I think there's a certain stigma that comes with the idea of a domestic violence victim. One of the first things I did with the press was I told them to change whenever they were covering me to survivor, not victim, which they do most of the time. And every survivor I've ever met has been incredibly strong. You know, they've survived things that you know, you can't even imagine.
Why did you decide, okay, I'm going to take this and I'm going to talk about it and talk about it and talk about it, and I'm going to use it to try and change something?
Well, I think a lot of people's approach with domestic violence is if they ignore it, it will just go away. And there's a detachment and otherness and stigma that comes with that. And I still face it. I know it's just part of what I'm doing right now because it's a topic that makes people uncomfortable. I mean, literally, it hits close to home because most people have domestic violence in their family. Most people's mothers experienced it. Most people, you know, and it's very hard. A lot of people want to brush under the rug and not confront it. I mean, I've experienced it with my own family members and my family. I honestly feel it's my purpose as a vocalist and as a survivor that because I had such small margins to survive, I have this duty to talk for all the women who are shot to death every month. They don't have a voice anymore. And I shudder to think of what my narrative would have been in the paper, what would have happened if I had died. And so the biggest thing that has brought life back to me and allowed for me to integrate my, you know, blues singer self with my advocacy self is just vocalizing it.
What's an example of a song that you think does all of those things? I mean, music can definitely do that, but it's a lot for a single song to be able to do.
We have this song called Stop the Violence, Start the Healing.
Stop the violence, start the healing. No more silence. How you feel?
What is it about being a blues singer that allows you to get stronger when you talk about this?
You know, the blues began as spirituals that slaves were singing in the fields, and they were, you know, singing about their heartache, and that was the way for them to process. And it was a way for me, even before I got shot and I didn't want to talk about my own domestic violence, to talk about these difficult, painful things in a way that's really easy for people to go along with and follow.
Changes in the air. People are starting to care. What are we fighting for? 'Cause I've been keeping score.
It's interesting to think about the person you described yourself as before the shooting. You said you were someone who spoke your mind and said what you thought, but you did not talk about what was happening in your relationship. And now you have multiple venues and multiple ways to talk about that so that other people can hear and they can reflect on what's happening in their own lives. What do you get out of being able to do that?
It's really liberating. You know, no one can keep a secret like a domestic violence survivor, especially in the thick of a relationship. And there's always that feeling, like I don't really get it too much anymore, but, you know, it's like, I'm not supposed to tell you these things. I'm really not supposed to be talking about that.
What does it mean to you to be able to know that you've ditch that idea that you're not supposed to talk about this. This should stay a secret.
It really feels like it's a instinctual thing.
What do you mean?
Since I started talking about it, I just feel like it wasn't really a choice. That it just was like, you have to do this. You must keep doing this, no matter what, no matter how down you get or how many people try to tell you to stop. And it's cool to meet other people who are starting to talk about it and feel open about it. And it's, you know, making more and more people feel like it's acceptable to say these things.
How are you different as a result of understanding that it's absolutely acceptable to say these things?
In some ways, I think it softened me and made me seem more human. And I think in other ways, it's allowed me to really connect with people because I'm, you know, exposing a deep, painful vulnerability in a way that's not full of, you know, doom and it doesn't have a sad ending. Like it has a happy ending. You know, when people criticize me or judge me or send me hate mail, I'm much more likely to have belief in my convictions and know that in my heart that this is why I'm alive.
Courtney Weaver is a blues singer. She's a domestic violence survivor. She has a new album out called Paper Tiger, holding a record release party for that in August 21st at Columbia City Theater. She talked with KUOW's Jeannie Yandel. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You've heard this before. Leave the wildlife alone. At least 2 seal pups have died so far this year as a result of human interference. Wildlife officials say you should leave seal pups alone, even if that pup looks abandoned, even if it seems like it could use your help. Michael Milstein with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration told me how a woman in Westport, Washington, did the wrong thing when she encountered a lonely seal pup.
The woman saw a seal pup on the beach, got worried about it, thought that it was abandoned and was going to die, and picked it up in a shopping tote and took it home, then was not sure what to do and ended up calling the Westport Aquarium. They contacted the state Fish and Wildlife folks and went out there. They looked at the pup, unfortunately found that by that point the pup had become lethargic and unresponsive, and they made the determination that it needed to be euthanized.
Do you think that woman kind of killed the pup? Or it was sick anyway?
Well, no, very likely it was healthy. Have you seen the picture of it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's plump and healthy and looked well taken care of. You can actually see a bit of the umbilical cord still attached. So
yeah.
it was very young, and likely the mother had parked it on the beach for a while and would have come back.
And how often is that lonely-looking pup going to be just fine, and how often really will it die?
You know, the hard reality of life in the wild is that many of the pups will die. We'll see 3,000 to 5,000 pups born in Puget Sound each year. Up to half of those may not make it.
Okay, so maybe thousands of pups will die if left alone. I mean, if I see a pup, and I don't know, if I think it looks emaciated or it's not moving around or it's hurt or it looks sick or something, should I just do nothing and let it die?
Certainly, if there's a sign that the pup is injured or in trouble in some way, you should definitely call our Stranding Network hotline. It's a 24-hour hotline, and that's what it's there for. If it does appear that the separation from the mother is permanent, we'll consider whether the pup is a good candidate for rehabilitation. But the reality is we can't save every animal.
Okay, so you're not saying never interfere with nature, you know, death is part of life. I mean, you do try to come in and save some pups, but you want to make that decision, not us, you know, tourists and beachgoers.
Yeah, that's correct. And there aren't the facilities available to take in every pup that people see on the beach. So the first step and the priority is to do everything we can to keep that pup in the wild.
So finally, Michael, is there something you want to say about what attitude you wish we beachgoers, nature visitors would have? Are we getting something a little bit wrong and you want us to
approach it differently? I think there's a natural human instinct when you see particularly a very young animal on the beach or somewhere like that and feel that it's in trouble, the instinct is to try to help it. But the challenge in this case is to realize that that really doesn't necessarily help it, and in many cases may actually hurt it in the long term by interfering in its ability to stay wild and to learn the tools and tricks of the trade that they need to make it out there in the long term.
That's Michael Milstein, spokesperson for NOAA Fisheries, telling you how to handle the sight of a lonely pup. We are tweeting out a link to NOAA's Stranded Marine Animal Hotline. We've tweeted that out now on Twitter at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in to The Record here, KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. It has been about 8 months since Mayor Ed Murray declared a Seattle state of emergency around homelessness. So what's changed? Well, Mayor Murray says the declaration has made more resources available, local and federal, but there's still a lot to be done. One big idea involves a shakeup of Seattle's shelter system.
Our shelter system has not gone through a competitive contracting process for over a decade. They're basically designed for a different time and a different situation. It is our hope going forward in a series of proposals we're about to make that we'll start to get more innovative and more flexible in those folks that we contract with to do shelters. And as you know, I'm working to bring a navigation center here like San Francisco has started. And the idea there is you take people where they are as a group, because they often form communities and support groups out in the unauthorized encampments, bring them in regardless of whether they're using or not, bring them in regardless of who they're sharing their life with or regardless if they have a pet. And in San Francisco, there's some indication that this progress is actually getting people out of homelessness and keeping them out of homelessness. But I do want to make a very important point. We generally at the council and in the media focus on shelters and encampments, and that will do nothing to end homelessness. We need to focus upstream on how we get people the treatment they need, how we actually provide enough permanent housing. Shelters is a short stop gap measure, and that doesn't solve homelessness.
As long as we're on shelters for now, I wonder, what do you think of giving people places to use the drugs they're addicted to with staff supporting and counseling them?
So I think that's an excellent idea. And I think the challenge for us is to work through the federal prohibitions against that at the moment. But I think it'd be a great way to reduce deaths, disease, and offer more of an opportunity to get people into treatment.
Let's talk about what you called upstream solutions to the problem in permanent housing. That sounds like your big vision. So where's our progress on that?
So one of the most important things that Seattle can do this year is passing and renewing the housing levy, which is one of the reasons that we do better than most cities when it comes to affordable housing, and given we're in a terrible affordable housing crisis. But it's still one of the things we can do to produce thousands of units, both for folks who are working and many who live in shelters, as well as for folks who are homeless. So that's one key part of it. You know, the next key part of it is over the last 35 years, we've basically seen the federal government step away from models of funding housing, whether it's for folks who can't afford housing or folks who just can't afford to get that first house. And it has been the shutting down of that that is causing such a shortage of new housing across the nation. So it's going to take a combination of things, but we need to restore the lost federal funds.
Is your vision to have no one sleeping in parks, doorways, under bridges, or to have shelter if people do want it? What is your realistic vision?
People in this country should not be homeless. My vision is that we actually provide the housing that people need. But part of that vision is going to have to be a huge increase in expenditure on the part of the state. I mean, the city doesn't do mental health and it doesn't fund drug addiction. Those are county and state functions. A significant infusion of funds dealing with mental illness and dealing with this massive heroin epidemic is one of the ways we can get there. Affordable housing, not just at the city level, but at the federal level, is one of the ways we get there. Dealing with income inequality, not just in the city of Seattle where we lead the nation, but across the country, is how we get there. What I worry about is that a progressive city like Seattle is sort of formed a circular firing squad, shooting at each other over who's to blame for homelessness. This constant Seattle City Council, Seattle Mayor, Seattle Human Service Agencies, whatever, you're to blame, versus recognizing that we are in a national crisis, the like that we have not seen since the Great Depression. And it will take not just a local, but a national response. And you don't get there if you're just like shooting at each other. That's not a way to convince Republicans in the U.S. Senate or conservative Democrats in the legislature to step up and become our partners. Sometimes I feel like I'm the last hopeful progressive in the city when I hear people say, Mayor, we'll never get the feds to change. Well, you know, I can remember as a young man when all my friends were dying of HIV/AIDS, I saw a movement come together and turn a negligent federal government into a government that actually funded programs that didn't end AIDS, but got it to a point that people can live and go to work with AIDS and HIV. I think we can do that with homelessness. I absolutely believe we can.
If some people want to live outside, is that acceptable to you?
Well, generally, if they're outside creating garbage and they have an option to go into housing, no, it's not acceptable. But I have found in the conversations I've had with people who are homeless, the encampments I visit, including underneath I-5, you're mostly dealing with people who are pretty much in some state of significant addiction or mental illness. It's going to take a lot of time and a lot of return trips to finally get them to move. So it's going to take some time.
Mayor, you're in a position of authority. Some of us listening wonder, what can we do? What can someone listening to you right now do?
I have a whole list of things that people can do. You know, there are a lot of great organizations in this city that work on homelessness. I would ask people, get involved, give money. Next, I would ask people to educate themselves on the issue and engage not just the mayor and the council members. I mean, keep pushing us, but also our legislature and our congressional delegation. And quite honestly, this should be one of the main debating points during the presidential campaign.
Finally, Mayor, is there anything you want to say to someone who's living right now without shelter in the city of Seattle?
There is, you know, nothing more tragic for me as mayor than to know that people are in this city and go to sleep in this city without any shelter. We are trying everything we can to find a way to get the help that you need. I know we need to do more. We'll continue to try and find a way to increase the amount of housing, to reconnect you with your family if that's an issue, to try and get you the treatment you need if you're addicted or mentally ill. We want to work with you.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray on homelessness in Seattle and what you can do to help. KUOW is spotlighting the issue of homelessness today, along with other Seattle news media. Find links to our most recent coverage on Twitter at KUOW. Join the conversation on Twitter and Facebook. Search the hashtag SeaHomeless, S-E-A Homeless. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. One reason British voters are leaving the European Union is they don't want that European central government making trade deals that give away jobs, which sounds like what Donald Trump says about trade deals. For example, Trump hates the North American Free Trade Agreement the U.S. has with Canada and Mexico.
We have become more dependent on foreign countries than ever before. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to declare our economic independence once again.
Economic independence? That is not what the leaders of Canada, Mexico, and the United States are talking about today. They're meeting right now in Canada's capital, and we've got Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer with us. Hi, Vaughn.
Hi, Bill. I'm just watching them here on Canadian television, the three leaders doing a press conference. And yes, Bill, their very first question was about what does the Brexit mean for you? They answered that question by saying we need to work together and cooperate and maintain trade and all sorts of wonderful things. No mention of Trump, but I don't think there's any question that he is the man who's not there who haunts the North American leaders meeting today.
How are Canadians reacting to Great Britain voting to leave the European Union? I believe you have Queen Elizabeth on your money.
Oh, yeah, she's going to stay there. You know, she's still our queen.
But you don't have to leave,
too. We're not going to be talking United Kingdom anymore, though. I think we may have to retire that term.
Yes.
But look, you get the full range here. I mean, we've had two headlines this week that sort of said it all. One was Brexit fallout could silence NAFTA critics, we hope. And the other one was the one you just quoted, Trump. NAFTA is the worst trade deal in the history of the known world. So, look, I think if the president of Mexico and the prime minister of Canada could have their way, Barack Obama would be a shoo-in for a third term. They're delighted to be meeting with him in Ottawa today. He's going to address the Canadian Parliament later today. I think it's going to be a love-in myself, and the very strong message coming from all three leaders at this press conference they're just having in Ottawa right now is North Americans need to work together. They need to caucus more. We've accomplished a great deal together, and we can accomplish more. Globalization is here. We need to think about the people that aren't doing so well under globalization, but we can't go back to the nostalgia of the past. The three countries need to work more closely together, not drift apart.
Vaughn, in the minute and a half or so we have left, did they announce anything impactful in the summit so far?
Yeah, I like the range of what they've talked about, Bill. They have an agreement, a new agreement on climate change. The three countries have set a target by 2030 to have 50% of the energy in North America be generated from clean power. They're going to work together to reduce methane gas emissions. Canada and Mexico have a new deal on visa travel and access to beef. And I give the nod to the president of Mexico for talking about the importance of working together to save the monarch butterfly. Now, if that isn't sweetness and light, I don't know what is.
Vaughn Palmer simultaneously talking on the radio and watching TV, watching Obama and Trudeau and Peña Nieto. And thanks for telling us about it, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Vaughn is, of course, our columnist at the Vancouver Sun, joins us regularly here on The Record. And today, later today, in about an hour or so, President Obama is scheduled to address the Canadian Parliament as part of that North American Leaders Summit. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. We have formed a Facebook group called Ask Seattle's Homeless Community as part of our homeless coverage today. Anybody at that Facebook group can ask a question. Only people who have been homeless can answer. And you can search on Facebook for Ask Seattle's Homeless Community. And we've tweeted out a link to that at KUOW. Thank you for tuning in today.